Snappers, we've got an amazing episode for you. But first, know that Friday the 13th approaches, the final day of the Support Snap Judgment campaign, after which I'm going to walk into a meeting with the man, turn over the cards, let him know whether or not 5,000 Snappers have stepped up to join this special thing we have together. Even though we're not there, with this crazy ambitious call, I'm starting to let myself get excited because as of 30 seconds ago, almost 4,000 Snappers have joined us in this amazing, magical, fragile thing we call Snap Storytelling. And just 4 days left, just four, I think, that Snap Nation's support of storytelling that matters is about to make national news and podcast history. Be a part of it at snapjudgment.org. $2, $2,000, whatever storytelling that matters is worth to your life. I'm asking. And if you look forward to seeing that new Snap podcast alert in your podcatcher, join the team that makes that magic possible, snapjudgment.org. We've got great stuff to help you tell your story, or even sit in on a virtual Snap story meeting, see how the snap gets made when Davey Kim and Nancy Lopez go toe-to-toe. It is not to be missed. Or do what we do when we're trying to make something. A story, a song, a painting, whatever. Rub the lamp and unleash your genie. I'm going to send you a Snap magic lamp. I promise it will help you unleash your own power. You felt the magic. Get your own at snapjudgment.org. So pause the show. Pause it for a moment. You know you're one of us. You know this. You've got headphones on. You're waiting for storytelling that matters right now. Right now, pause your show and be counted as someone who makes this possible. Snapjudgment.org. Photographers call it the magic hour. There are a few moments twice a day at dusk and dawn where day and night dance together. Neither dark nor light, but both at the same time. The sky shimmers, grins, swirls, impossible paints on the biggest canvas before welcoming morning or ushering night. And if you love the sky, you know that magic hour is almost certainly the right term because it is magic, but it ain't an hour. More likely, it's just a moment, a perfect moment of balance before the darkness or the light takes over, declares victory. And every time I sit and watch these warring parties, these dancing partners, light and dark, inside myself, I feel my own magic moment. And I always wonder who's going to win. Well, today on Snap Judgment, we proudly present Twilight. Amazing stories from the dark and the light. And I want to get right into it with a piece from an amazing brother, someone who I've made it my next year's goal to get to know a little bit better because I understand I've only scratched his surface. From Snap Judgment Live, we proudly present
Mr. Shane Poisson. Raised by my grandparents. Now, the three things you need to know about my granddad are: number one, and probably most important, he had an intense love for beef jerky. Two, he had the kind of temper that could be likened to a levee bursting apart on a hot, dry day. A cache of anger stored away for any given moment on any given day. My grandmother used to say he was one half volcano and one half hurricane. A handful of excuses and a gut full of pain. And because of this, we come to number three. My granddad had a way with monsters. As a child, I slept in a bedroom full of them. A closet stuffed with long-legged demons who could make it from one end of the room to the other in a single step. My strep throat silence was born from night terrors. When screaming was not enough, so I instead kicked the wall. Drew my first remembered breath the moment I heard thunder storm down the hall, then burst through my door like a war on its way to a peace protest. My granddad would rest his hands on his hips, let his fingertips grip his boxers and lift them up past his waist. Standing like a superhero in the doorway, he would split the night with a whisper and say, "All right, you I swear to Christ, I will turn on a damn light." Never has any monster ever heard a battle cry more terrifying than "I will turn on a light." And every night for more than 4 years, my granddad took boogeymen by the ears and threw them out on their asses. Dragged the carcasses of dead monsters out of my room, grabbed a broom and swept what was left of my nightmares into a dustpan, emptied them into a trash can, then turned around to say, "Sweet dreams, my boy. I'll be down the hall if you need me." We were sidekicks. I'd sound the alert, and my granddad would put the hurt on whatever was hiding under my bed or lurking in my closet. He'd deposit his foot so deep into the asses of gargoyles that when they finally turned back into stone, he could wear them as platform boots to a Kiss concert. My granddad used to wear a red polo shirt to bed. He said it used to be white. But one night when I was 4, he busted down my bedroom door and had to kick some ass because I was screaming. Now he wears it as a warning, teaching nighttime there are some things far worse than morning. A night terror differs from a nightmare in that the dreamer will awake and take terror with them back into consciousness. Add to this the fact that the dreamer rarely recalls what they dreamt, and that any attempt to wake them usually ends unsuccessfully. I know this now, but think constantly how my granddad had to just stand there, wait for it to end, and believe everything was gonna be okay. How the following day he'd pretend not to be tired. An alarm clock wired into fears I could not recall. He'd wake and thunder down the hall, doing the very best he could. He'd be there. An anchor pulling me back from the somewhere I could not escape. As a child, I learned not every hero wears a cape. Not everyone gets a ticker tape parade just for having patience. Not everyone has the strength needed to stand there, wait for it to end, and believe everything's going to be okay. Not everyone has the courage to say or do nothing when a child is screaming, dreaming of eternity in a room with no doors, no floors to keep you from falling further into panic. Each once small fear suddenly titanic in its implications, situations so far beyond grotesque. I would have amputated my own imagination just to make them stop. But at the end of each one, he'd be there. And he'd say, "Close your eyes. I'm going to turn on a light." He'd invite me back to consciousness with a tired smile. The next day, he would sit on the sofa before dinner and say, "I just need to rest my eyes." My quest to end night terrors was born from the night he ended up falling asleep at the wheel and driving full speed into a snowbank. My one-man think tank kicked into overdrive. And for 5 nights in a row, my granddad slept soundly. Free from worry, we watched the light return to his eyes as if it had just come back from some long vacation. But on night number 6, the kicks against the bedroom wall made thunder storm down the hall once more. He stood in the doorway, ready to wage war, ready to restore light to darkness, to dismiss shadows, to land heavy-handed blows, Muhammad Ali combos that would give monsters pause to reconsider the options. Get up or stay down. Stay down. That night, he was hungry for a first-round knockout. He was about to go through his usual checklist of monster hiding spots when I said, "No, it's okay. Go back to bed. With renewed enthusiasm, he looked at me and said, "Nonsense. These have to pay." And I remember the way he dropped to his knees, stuck his head under my bed and said, "What the f*** is all of my beef jerky doing under here?" I explained to him my not-so-brilliant plan. I said, "I thought if I kept them fed, they'd leave me alone and you could get a good night's sleep." Slow but deep, his lips crept across his face, then cracked open into laughter. After a childhood of expecting only anger, he laid down on the ground, his lungs kicking at his chest. Every suppressed joy suddenly brought to the surface. This is the first time I can recall hearing my granddad laugh. Some thoughts are kept in closets, hanging next to skeletons and boogeymen. Sometimes when we believe in monsters, they take up residence under our beds. Our heads fill with the dread needed to keep them fed. We tread our own fear because we somehow thought it was better off being kept secret. It should come as no surprise that some hearts are like dark bedrooms, tombs that we allowed ourselves to shut because we thought that way everything will be all right. I think about my granddad's laugh. I think often about that night, about how some people are waiting for people like us to slide our hands against their walls and say, "Close your eyes. I'm going to turn on a light."
Shane Quaison, Snap Judgment Live. I'm not going to belabor this point, Snappers. If you felt that, if you were in that room, if you remember what it was like to be a child, what it's like to know perfect love from imperfect people, understand that Snap doesn't happen by accident or by chance. This is fragile. It happens because Snappers care enough and know this is valuable enough to step up and support it at snapjudgment.org. Own a piece of what you just heard. Pause the program you're listening to so you can support the program you're listening to at snapjudgment.org. Next on the Snap Judgment Twilight Special, we're examining this dance between light and dark. We're going to return to Snap Judgment Live right here in Oakland, California, where one of Oakland's native sons made a very big splash. Please put your hands together for Mr. Ice Life.
I remember when I didn't know I was black. I didn't know better. I mean, I had no sense of one group of people being better than or greater than another. At best, I knew that certain people belonged in certain places. For example, the orange people that spoke something my mama called Spanish, they lived in the Fruitvale, and they sold fruit in bags. The people who were the same color as my grandma, they were on TV, you know, like the news. And also, there were cartoons. Elmer Fudd, Yosemite Sam, Daffy Duck was a duck. But somehow I knew he was the same color as my grandma too. The kids I went to school with sleepy eyes, they were from far away. And they always had rice in their lunch bags. peanut butter jelly sandwiches and Capri Suns went in mine. My grandma was born Billy Matzker in 1933 to a family of poor Irish farm workers. Yes, me. Revolutionary black power rapper man, me. My first best friend was an old white lady, my grandma, and I loved her very much. I guess because she grew up poor on a farm, she knew how to make fun out of absolutely nothing. Well, I'd say nothing. Grandma say nothing. For example, she'd take the peaches that came in cans and she'd dump them in the sink, you know, and then she'd put the cans on the ground and she'd tap holes in the cans. And then she'd run string through the cans up to the height of my hands. And in her groggy voice, she'd go, "Stand on the cans, Isaac." And I'd get on the cans and she'd put the string in my hands like reins. They were stilts. I'd walk around the yard 6 inches taller than I really was. Clank, 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 clank. I felt like a giant. The kids I went to school with, they made a big deal out of me having a white grandma. Most of us never got to see white people up close unless it was the police. So me having a white grandma meant I got to see Bigfoot up close. She'd pull up to the school to pick me up. They'd go, "That's your grandma?" And I'd go, "Yep." And I'd run off to the car. Grandma had this long, old, gold Ford. It didn't have a tape deck. It didn't even have an FM radio. But Grandma didn't care. AM radio provided the soundtrack for old white lady daily life. The songs always had this real kind of, you know, slow, boring, and redundant, easy to dance to. Reminiscent of Jim Crow, but sounds like music to you. But I didn't know they were old white lady songs. I just knew they were songs that my grandma liked. I'd be right next to her singing along. As I got older, I stopped getting picked up by grandma and I started catching the bus to her house by myself. I graduated from my peach can stilts to bouts of Scrabble with my grandmother. Me and my grandma, we played Scrabble. It's when I first fell in love with the concept of tying words together, you know? Not only did I graduate from my peach can stilts, I also graduated from my naive view on race. By the time I was 12 years old, I was quite clear that in this country, white meant better. Not only did I graduate from my naive view on race, so did my homies at school. They went from thinking it was cool that I had a white grandma to teasing me for it. That didn't bother me. What did bother me, though, was commentary from two homies in my hood, Kevin and Brandon. Brandon joined the Nation of Islam, and he was 19 when I was 12, so we all thought he was like a super grown-up, you know? He'd stand booming from the corner like it was a podium. All white people are devils. They're all racist. They enslaved black people. They enslaved the whole world. It would drive me crazy. I'd argue with him, going on and on about how that wasn't true. My grandmother was proof. She was a white woman married to a black man and had black children. How could she be racist? Here came Cool Kev. Blood. Just because she be around black people don't mean she ain't racist. Black people don't like black people, so you know white folks don't. I felt defeated on the issue, but not about my grandma. I knew she wasn't racist, and she loved me very much. The summer that I was 14 years old, I went and spent the summer with my brother in Fresno, and my sisters, they flew down to San Diego to spend time with our uncle. When I got back home, I landed at the airport. My mama said, "Ice, where you want to go?" What did I say? Grandma's house. Off we went. We got there, and right away, Grandma started setting up the Scrabble board. She started asking me all the questions that grandmas ask, you know, "How was your trip? How's your brother? Did you eat?" Like I'm not gonna eat. Did you talk to your sisters while you were gone? No, but Connie wrote me a letter. She said they're getting dark tans down there from all the sun. And then my world changed forever. My grandmother reached across the table and touched my hand. She said, oh no, they're gonna come back looking like little niggers. I fell down inside. Then I died a little. I can't tell you what happened next. I don't know if it was nighttime or daytime when we left. I regained consciousness in my bed, weeping, mourning. The way it feels to mourn something you hold tight against the fabric of your being. The thing I was holding on to with all of my young might. The part of me that didn't want to live in a world where anyone, and surely not my grandmother, saw me as a nigger, useless, a dumb fuck. For the years that grew into my teenage years, I imagine I saw my grandmother no more than a dozen times. We never talked about it, and I just used it as another layer on the callus to weather day-to-day life in the hood. Recently, though, I started writing my grandmother a letter. I wrote about what I felt like she took away from me that day in the kitchen. How it made me feel. From a space of growth, I also wrote about my travels and everywhere I've been because I knew she'd enjoy that. And for a moment, I felt a certain nostalgia and it was good to feel her close to me again. My grandmother died before I could deliver my letter. And with her death, also went the opportunity for us to confront this issue and maybe put it behind us. Love conquers hate. But where was the love? Thank you.
The original music you just heard from both of those pieces was composed by Alex Mandel and performed in real time by Alex and the Snap Players, David Brandt and Tim Frick. Now, we're going to keep it 100. And our next story, too, it has a lot of Oakland heart and soul in it, but it starts with Sean Hayes, whom you may know from the song Powerful Stuff.
Powerful, powerful.
But Sean's story does not start with his music. It starts with a book that was given to him as a present.
And inside the book, there was a bunch of different stories. And one of the stories was taken from a radio program called Tossing Away the Keys, which was about men who had been serving death row sentences in Angola prison. A lot of the men are afraid they're going to be forgotten in jail. They had interviewed several of these men. The one that stuck out was named Maurice Bickham, who had been in Angola prison, I think, for 40-some years, and fortune in those years was on death row in solitary confinement. Here is the tape from Tossing Away the Keys.
My name is Maurice Bickham. My number is 75251, and I'm 72 years old. I've been in prison since 1958. 31 years later, and I'm still locked up. My crime is murder.
In 1958, he had been in a fight with his girlfriend and the police showed up and he got into an argument with them and supposedly they were Dragon Clan's members. They said they were going to come back and get him later that night to kill him and he went home and then later that night they did show up. They shot at him and he got shot. And he shot both of those police officers. He was a black man living in a white neighborhood, and of course nobody came forward to witness what they had saw in his neighborhood. So he was put on trial and sentenced to death and spent 14 years in solitary confinement before the death penalty was abolished in Louisiana. So then he served out life without parole. One of the things that he talked about in the story was tending these rose bushes and how they gave him hope and extra meaning serving his sentence.
Come over here. I want to introduce you to the beautiful rose bush on the whole yard. This is one here is my favorite. I named it after my wife, Ernestine. It's a beautiful pink rose. And some way or another, I keep it trimmed and uniform up until I call it my beauty. I know it sounds funny, but these are my company keepers. I enjoy these bushes. See, if it wasn't for these bushes, I wouldn't have nothing to do. So these bushes have come to be close, very close to me.
What really stuck out to me was this man who had such dignity in his voice and his outlook, even though he had spent all these years in prison and really had no hope of getting out. He still did have hope, and he's just, he didn't have any blame in his voice for his situation. And so it stuck with me, and I wrote a song called Rosebush Inside, and in the song I just wanted to remind myself to be grateful for what I have. Just kind of an everyday little mantra to sing to yourself sometimes when you're waiting in traffic and getting angry about silly things.
He was wrongly accused, 40 years and still survived. Don't you know, not for a moment, no. You think the world owes you, she don't owe you a thing.
I wanted people to know about his story, and that's why beside the title I put Maurice Bickham, but then one of the letters in his name on the record had got misspelled. So then I reblogged about it after I put the record out, just to let people know and point people towards his story. I never did write him. I thought about it, but you know, in the back of my head I was thinking he probably already had passed away. And then it wasn't until years after that that I got a little strange email. And I opened it and said, "Dear Mr. Hayes, I was listening to your song, Rosebush, which was from me when I was in Angola, and it's my great desire to visit your performance at the rickshaw stop in January 2009.
If it was possible, it would be a pleasure for you to make it available for me and my family and friends to come and see you perform and meet you in person. Thank you and God bless you. My name is Maurice Bickham. God bless America. Home sweet home, I'm glad to be in it."
Maurice had survived 37 years in prison and always retained this faith that he would get out.
I had strong hopes of getting out. I locked up on a Saturday morning. Monday night I said, "Lord, I'm in trouble. I want to know if I'm going to get out of it." Honey, I don't know who I was in, a dream or vision or what, but my grandmother come back to put in my bed and talk with me just like I'm talking with you.
A vision of family members that had passed came and said he would make it through this.
So Mama said, "Go, do help others all you can." I said, "I'm gonna start right now," and that's what I did. Doing everything I could to help others, and I kept my record straight.
I think the straight record is actually what saved him. The producer who made the radio piece, David Isay, started a campaign to free Maurice. So a judge commuted his sentence to 37.5 years on good behavior, miraculously.
My lawyer says to me, "Bickham, you stayed in 37 years. What you gonna be when you get out? It's just a plain old Bickham up and down the street." I got out on January 10, 1996. I never will forget that day. That was the happiest day of my life. Oh, it was one Wednesday morning. It was kind of amazing. And the warden, when we walked to the front gate, he said to me, "Bickham, what you thinking about?" I said, "I'm thinking about them 7 times y'all give me a death sentence at 1201. I said, "Now tonight at 1201, I'm signing myself out." He shook my hand and said, "Have good luck." I said, "That's all I can have." And I walked out, kneeled ground, picked up some of that dirt, kissed it, put it back there, and here I am today. My being locked up was a wonderful experience and a blessing to me. And people said, "What? How could it be a blessing?" Well, I like fast cars. And if I'd have been out, I'd have wrapped one around a telegram post or a bridge or something, been dead. You know, God checked me, put me in a prison, took care of me. Out now. And anybody drive a little over speed limit, I don't want to ride with them. Being free is being able to make your own decisions. You have to bear your own burden that comes out of your own decision.
Now Maurice is 95, and his dignity and his joy for life to find me and to come out and go to a rock and roll show late at night and show up, he's just living so much more fully than so many people who are 20 even, with no anger, even though he's been through something none of us could imagine. He showed up to the show in a limousine with his friend, and they were both dressed full on. The nines came in, got to meet him and talk to him for a while. He was mystified at where I heard the story, and he wondered if I'd maybe spent time in prison with him. I played the song, you know, right away. I wanted to introduce it. It was such a strange story to try to tell an audience full of people. People are understanding this in a much bigger way.
There's a man doing time, keeping the rose bush alive. He was wrongly accused, 40 years and still survived.
There's a man. Oh boy, it was beautiful. Everybody was dancing. Well, he had some songs that I really loved. But the one by the rose bush, it kind of brought back memories, you know? It made me feel that the thing that I longed for had come to be reality. Like when I'd be sitting on that bush, hoping that I'd be out someday. Now I'm out and feel good to know that somebody still remembers me.
And now the responsibility and the understanding of how stories work is more being revealed to me. You can't help but change the story by telling a story. You actually become part of a story. So it's a strange responsibility to be aware of.
Don't you know you got all the sunshine for a moment, Lord. You got all the sunshine to think the world owes you. You got all the sunshine, it don't owe you a thing. You got all the sunshine.
Thank you so much to David Isay, the founder of StoryCorps. He produced Tossing Away the Keys, and we thank him for letting us use his tape on our show. Thanks as well to Sean Hayes. He made all the music in this piece. And finally, thank you. Thank you, Maurice Bickham, for sharing your story with Snap.
Snap judgment. That it's good. It's good sometimes to think a matter over before you make decision. I don't make no swift decision no more. I say like this: if it's too important to rest overnight on, well, I do not have much to do with it, you know.
Maurice Bickham passed away recently, and Oakland lost a little bit of itself. I'll be forever thankful for getting to meet him at Snap Studios, and we're powerfully grateful as well to everyone who helped make this story possible. You understand, of course, that you won't hear this somewhere else. They don't think it matters, but you know better, and we know better too. So as Friday the 13th approaches, just a couple more days, three more days, make sure that Snap gets to tell stories like that of Maurice Bickham. Only someone like yourself, listening to the closing words of a podcast, someone who knows how extremely important these stories are, how sacred, someone that wants to shock the world next week knowing that you were a part of Snap's success, someone like you can make this happen. Go to snapjudgment.org. Pick a gift that works for you. Give at a level that works for you, but declare yourself a snapper. Because stories matter. Snapjudgment.org.